This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
This week on Hangar Talk, another setback for Icon.
And prop inspections top the NTSB safety lookout.
Sun and Fun celebrates its 50th anniversary. We were there.
Lycoming blames UND. UND blames Swift. Swift blames UND for their fuel issues with valve recession.
That is a mess, David. I'm looking so forward to talking about that.
I'm pretty sure I mixed it up, but we'll get to it in just a minute and sort it all out.
From AOPA, your freedom to fly. This is Hangar Talk.
1056, turn right, heading 130, contact final 132.4. Turn right,
sky back. With your hosts, Ian Twombly and David Tulitz. This is Hangar Talk.
Welcome to Hangar Talk, everybody. I'm Ian Twombly.
And I'm David Tulitz.
David, our guest this week is Maurice Frizerin. He's a pilot based down in the kind of the Palm Beach area, Southeast Florida, and he's got some cool toys.
He does. Julie Walker interviewed him, thanks to Michelle Walker for getting the audio, and we spent some time with Maurice down at West Palm Beach. We'll hear more about his toys, two Marchetti jets, two Gazelle helicopters.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Two? I thought it was only one.
No.
Oh, this guy likes to buy stuff in pairs, doesn't he?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
And he's a great guy, a really interesting person. And folks who are listening and are going to go to AirVenture this year, look out for Maurice because he's going to perform in the air show.
Oh, cool. Okay, so he is going to be coming up in the June issue of Pilot, I think the Turbine edition.
Right.
Before that, though, folks are going to get the May edition into their mailboxes. And lots of cool stuff there. A couple that you shot, one, the Fly Compton, which is that program for youth in Southern California.
Yeah, in really a suburb of Los Angeles. And on Saturdays, Ian, the youth come out, they learn about aviation, they learn about what makes an airplane fly besides money. Then they get a chance to fly in aircraft. And several of those kids, or inner city kids, are going to move on to learning more about aviation, going to school for that in college. And so it's really opening a lot of avenues for younger pilots and a diverse crowd as well.
Okay, cool. So that's an Alicia Heron story. She also went up to Lake Tahoe and flew some seaplanes.
She
and
did.
I gotta say, with this story, for me, man, it's all about the photos. Unbelievable. Lake Tahoe. I've never been there, but holy cow, it looks gorgeous.
Oh, I've been there one time nearby, actually. Julie Walker and I were in that area, and it's a lake in the mountains. I mean, it's some difficult flying up there, especially in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
And Alicia does talk about that as well. And they describe safe flying techniques, a lot about seaplane flying. It's just beautiful. And folks who are going to get the magazine and look at that, they're probably going to want to fly out there. So, you know, get some good training before you do it.
Be prepared.
Right.
Yeah, right. Also, the story about the Hats biplanes, we had those guys on last episode, actually, so folks know about that.
Dual Hats is
yep.
A blue and a red.
Yep, yep. And then finally, a story that's kind of interesting for us, because actually Mike Collins shot it, and that's the Davis monoplane.
Right. The D1K, it's a golden age aircraft that was rescued. And it's really interesting. Mike Collins's wife, Jeanette, found some of the photos that Mike shot back in the day. And we published that story. Jill Tallman wrote the story. And the aircraft is really interesting. It's got a Kenner radial engine. It's a tail dragger, tube and fabric design, of course, because it's from the Golden Age. And it's a beautiful aircraft.
It is beautiful.
With some really beautiful photos. Absolutely.
Yep. Excellent. Okay, so that's the May issue. But first, let's talk about the news. So Icon in bankruptcy. Once again, looks like they're going to be sold. Of course, the Chinese company is the majority owner right now. I guess they have decided they're going to stop funding it. They're about $68 million in debt, David.
Ian, that's a lot of money. We just finished talking about Vans Aircraft having some trouble digging out of bankruptcy. But, you know, Icon came onto the scene really strongly. They started their first delivery back in 2016, the Icon A5. If you recall, and listeners probably will, that's an amphibious aircraft. And it upped the weight in the LSA category to something a little bit more than everyone else was having to deal with. Mm-hmm. And there was such promise with that aircraft because it came with an angle of an attack indicator. It was supposedly stall resistant, easy to fly.
Yeah.
And 1,500 people put down deposits, at least 1,500, right when that aircraft was just getting ready to be delivered.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. The Icon and the Eclipse stories are pretty similar in that there are all these sort of great marketing promises before it came out. But when you talk to owners, actually, they love it. I mean, people love the airplane. They love flying it. Dave Hirschman flew it back when it was first released. He loved it. And it's just, though, one of those companies that it's like, I think it's going to kind of struggle to kind of tick along. According to Gamma Numbers, they delivered about 209 of those 1,500. How many more do they have, you know, kind of waiting?
Right.
I don't know. It's hard to say because a lot of those deposits were AirVenture, you know, cheapies. But it's obviously there's some value there in the design. I mean, we know that.
Yes.
Like I said, it's a loved airplane.
It's a really cool aircraft. And like I said, spin resistant, like the Aircoupe, you know, which is fun to me. Of course, the Aircoupe's not an amphibious aircraft.
No. Not intentionally, at least.
No, right. And this one the Icon comes with a really nice panel, too, digital panel.
Yeah.
A lot of the modern conveniences, you know, the aircraft is just a sleek-looking airplane. But, Ian, it came in over budget, and it was originally projected to be about $139,000, which is pretty high for an LSA.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, the price is about $380,000, which is, that's like double.
Yeah.
So going up double probably hurt that a lot because if you have that kind of disposable income, I mean, do you want to buy an Icon A5 or do you want a boat? You know, do you want a big RV mobile home? You know, it's catering to that kind of clientele.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. It's a tale as old as time, unfortunately.
Right. And then the other thing that drew a lot of people's attention to the Icon was, unfortunately, some of the accidents that occurred. And a prelude to that is something that Dave Hirschman wrote about back when he reviewed this aircraft back in 2015. He says that the biggest danger for Icon is that pilots will be too impulsive and lack sufficient judgment and self-discipline. And Ian, that actually came to fruition a couple of years after that when Phillies pitcher Roy Halladay crashed his Icon A5 down in Florida.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the designers for the A5 aircraft also died in a low and slow accident. And so the aircraft, you know, exhibited such good traits, it really built the confidence of the pilots.
That's
right. But really, you still had to be very careful flying that airplane.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say here, and I don't think it's terribly controversial to say so, I'm going to say that Dave was wrong. And I don't mean that he was wrong in the sense that, you know, it's like people were going to do stupid things. But I don't think that the design and the marketing necessarily has led to, you know, some huge number of low and slow accidents, you know, CFIT accidents. I mean, if you think about any other airplane, they all have this sort of history where people get in and do stupid things. So, I think it got a bit of a bad rap for that. It did have a flashy marketing program at the beginning. There were lots of formation, low and slow.
I think that's what Dave was talking about, right? Because it looked like it was just a whole lot of fun to go out there. It's almost like, you know, being out on a motocross bike in the desert versus it being in an airplane that could do all that, you know, similar kind of maneuvers.
I get it. But like, okay, does the car press say, you know, every time they see a commercial of a Hellcat doing a power slide, it's like, oh, we can't show that because, you know, people are going to do that in their Hellcats. It's like, okay, some idiots are going to. Sure. But it's like, why can't we have fun, you know?
You bring up a good point. But we had that debate back in 2015, 2016, 2017 too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think most of the folks who did get an Icon, they do love them, like you said. In fact, Maurice has one too, I came to find out.
He doesn't have two?
Down in Florida. No, just one.
Okay.
He's waiting on a second. It appeals to a lot of people. That's a good pun. But you're right. You didn't hear that much beyond those couple of early accidents.
Yeah, there's just a few.
Yeah, folks really did get to know that aircraft. And it is a versatile aircraft. It's great to have, you know, wheels or floats. It just opens up a lot more terrain. But in my opinion, the main thing was that the price was really high.
Yeah, it's astronomical. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But they'll be back. No question, I think. Hey, NTSB says we need to keep more careful eye on our propellers. They've issued a safety alert citing three accidents. I guess that makes a trend, where they've looked at propeller safety and they found some aluminum, actually, propellers failing. Two of them on backcountry aircraft. So they've issued a safety alert basically saying, hey, guys, pay closer attention.
Right. Well, big surprise there, Ian. Aluminum propeller blades can be susceptible to fatigue, cracking, and fracture if a small nick, pit, or corrosion on the surface or edge is not found and repaired properly.
Yeah.
So in my case, with the Piper Tri-Pacer, I have to inspect that propeller every 25 hours visually with a mechanic, and it's a fixed pitch. And so this is not uncommon. You know, it's been going on for a while, but folks could get a little bit more lackadaisical about it. And, you know, let's face it, if you're flying in the backcountry, chances are higher that there'll be, you know, a piece of rock or something that could impact the aircraft.
Yes.
And you really need to do a thorough pre-flight inspection like you and I do all the time. Anyway.
Yeah. So the three accidents that they mentioned, it was interesting. The first one, actually, I'm going to go from bottom to top in their alert here, but the first one's a Cessna 185. It was taking off. The tip apparently came off, which is interesting. They determined that they think it wasn't actually as a result of necessarily something that happened during that takeoff. Basically, they think there was fatigue because the blade had apparently some pitting on it already and some corrosion on it already. And their basic point is, had they inspected properly during the preflight, it could have been avoided, as you say. There was another one, again, Macaulay, the prop failed. Apparently, the entire blade separated. The pilot performed a 180, came back to the runway. They found fatigue cracking. Again, they thought that they make the point here, which I want to get into a little bit, that had the prop been overhauled per the spec, that that would have been caught.
Uh-huh. Now, let's talk about that spec a little bit, Ian, before you move on. You're probably going to talk about a Beech Baron that also shed a prop blade on a recent flight. But the company, like Hartzell or Macaulay, will put out a recommended time before overhaul. Not out in an hourly time, but also a calendar date time. So is the NTSB advising us as Part 91 pilots to adhere to that, which is basically an advisory status if you're not flying Part 135, are they recommending that we do it on a calendar basis for the overhauls, or for how many hours have passed since the propeller's been in service and overhauled, or are they saying do it all?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
that's the short answer. They're saying basically adhere to the overhaul recommendations. They're there for a reason.
They are.
Yeah, and I will say just, if you listen to Ask the A&Ps and Mike Bush and Paul New and Colleen Sterling, they say, hogwash, do not do the prop overhauls necessarily given the calendar and hour time. They say, like a lot of their things, it should be on condition.
On condition inspection.
Yes.
Which should be every, you're going to visually inspect it every pre-flight, but once a year during annual, I would certainly hope your mechanic is going over that literally with a magnifying glass.
Yes, exactly. So what's interesting here is I think actually the point that the NTSB should be making is, and they do to a sense to the pre-flights, they say do a better pre-flight, but also it's like it seems like the annuals were improperly done in some of these if these weren't caught or addressed in annual. And so that's maybe the bigger issue here is not necessarily that the prop should have been sent out. It's that it should have been caught from a condition standpoint and dealt with. So I think, you know, they make kind of too big of a leap here. The overall point, I think, is valid in that, you know, we got to pay attention to these things.
Well, speaking of paying attention, Ian, you got a Piper Cub that you know and love dearly and you're flying it. Mm-hmm. I mean, let me just ask you, what kind of prop inspection do you do before you fly the Cub?
I'm kind of hands-on. So, I take my hand and kind of run it over the blade. I have a wood prop. It's a little easier because I do think that, you know, with metal blades sometimes, if you really put your hand on it, it actually, you know, you can cut yourself. But no, I've got that nice kind of rounded wood blade. And so, you know, I feel that leading edge strip and on both sides and kind of run my hand along the face of it. And that's kind of all you can do, right? There's not much more than that. And give it a visual inspection, obviously, front and back. And yeah.
Well, on the Tri-Pacer and even on the Cessna 172s that I and 182s that I take up, I do the same thing. I'll run my fingers over the leading edge of that blade from the hub to the tip and check it out. And generally, I give the propeller a little bit of a pull, a little bit of a nudge, you know, left and right sure. near the hub.
Yeah.
And that way, you're also then looking at the spinner, you know, which might have a loose screw or something. So
yeah.
I take all that into consideration, and I would hope that most pilots do the same thing. That's how I was taught.
Yeah. I will say one thing about this is I tend not to do, and I think maybe we talked about this a long time ago, if I'm doing multiple flights a day, I tend not to do a full pre-flight after every flight. I do kind of a walk around, you know, I'll do like a fuel oil check.
Okay.
Do a walk around to make sure there's no, you know, ramp rash or something like that. It does give me pause though, that maybe I should be checking the prop every time because obviously you'll pick stuff up on the ground and during takeoff and landing and taxiing. Yeah.
Especially for folks who are operating off airport.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of grass strips might come into that same conclusion. On a grass strip, something could fly up, you're not sure what, and probably not a bad idea to just run your hand over the prop even if you don't do much else before you get on. Yeah.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah. And we'll be right back.
David, Sun and Fun. It was a big one, the 50th. Big one for Sun and Fun.
50th anniversary. Not much news.
Yeah.
Not much news, but a good time was had by all.
That's right. So I think you had other obligations. I also didn't go, and so we watched it from afar.
Right.
But we heard good things. Like you said, good time had by all. It seemed like everybody was in a good mood. AOPA had a little gathering for our 85th anniversary that was successful, in part maybe because there might have been a few beverages.
There were. And we're going to do that again at AirVenture in July. So
yes.
Folks who are listening to us now, please be advised that as part of AOPA's 85th anniversary, which is in May, there's going to be pretty much an open house at the AOPA tent area, especially during the night air show on Wednesday night. I think also on Saturday, and maybe there may be other activities too. We'll have to stay tuned.
Mm-hmm.
But as part of the AOPA's 85th, we were down at Sun of Fun with our doors wide open and inviting people to come in and watch the evening air show from there too.
Yeah. So you mentioned not a lot of news. You know, we saw Junkers put out a kind of a new version that apparently adheres more to the historic version of the airplane, I guess.
And you're talking about the A-50 Junkers, which
yep.
came out last year. We did a big story on it in AOPA Pilot Magazine where Tom Horn flew it. And people were saying it's a great airplane, but it had more of a modern engine, had a Rotax engine. What about a radial? Let's put a radial on that thing and let's just do some other mods. And so that is exactly what happened with the A-50.
Yep. So otherwise, I think, you know, Dahar was there talking about their success. Delta Hawk was showing off their bigger engine, right?
Well, I think Delta Hawk might be a little bit of a story there, Ian, because one bit of news out of Sun and Fun. Now, we talked about Delta Hawk a couple of shows ago, that they were going to use that same design for the inverted V and up the horsepower to 200, 235, et cetera. There's actually a pretty good video. Thank you to our AvWeb folks that published that. There's a good video of sort of their plan to increase horsepower and increase the complexity of that engine, and maybe one day even become a six-cylinder engine. But they're going to put a pair of these Delta Hawk jet fuel piston engines on a Piper PA-44 Seminole. So that will be really interesting. I think flight schools might enjoy something like that.
Yeah.
And for the efficiency and perhaps even, you know, the appeal to these diesel engines, you know, goes through Europe and through Africa and through other parts of the world where regular avgas is hard to get.
Yep, absolutely. Also, we saw Dynon came with new 12-inch displays, the HDX 1200. Those are massive. I got to say, that's just a really interesting thing when you look at kind of the history of experimentals and where we went from, you know, basic six-pack and really small cockpits and everything now to these massive 12-inch. I mean, 12-inch display in an experimental, it's like, you know.
That's big.
It is.
Well, you know what? There's no way it'll fit in my Tri-Pacer, but I tell you what will fit in there. And that, by the way, $5,490 for the basic display.
That's
the 12-incher.
Pretty cheap, actually. It's incredible.
It is, actually, for that kind of a display.
Yeah.
And don't forget, when you buy the Dynon product, you can also get integrated transponder, radio. There's a bunch of other options that you can get that make that a real versatile unit.
Yes.
Especially if you're challenged for panel space. Now, like on the Tri-Pacer, I am challenged for panel space. This smaller unit, the 7-inch HDX 800, which still remains in the lineup at $3,420, will fit in my Tri-Pacer, and they are still making the 10-inch HDX 1100, which sells for a little bit less than $5,000. It's $4,759. And that's an interesting option for folks who might have a little bit more panel space to begin with and looking for more versatility. So those are very cool products.
But
it's a commitment. I mean, it's not, I don't think it's something that the average mechanic or the average owner can put in with the average mechanic. You really need an avionics tech shop to help you with that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But I mean, when you think about what you'd be spending on rondials and overhauls over the years and everything else, it's pretty cool to get that extra capability as well. Otherwise, from Sun and Fun, you know, big time kind of on the military air show side, like we've seen, they had the night air shows people loved. And then the other thing was a cryptic press conference from our friend George.
George Brawley, yeah.
Talking about this situation having to do with Lycoming and Swift and UND. And so lots of accusations have been thrown around in the past couple of days. Basically, what George said at this press conference is, I have some ideas on what's going on, but I'm not going to tell you.
Not yet. Stay tuned.
Yeah, the classic tease there, which is, you know, just not very nice.
Well, let's get our listeners up to date in case they weren't around and they didn't realize what was happening there with that UL 94 UL Swift fuel. I'll just let them know real quick. The University of North Dakota had the Swift 94 UL in operation for months and months and thousands of hours in these aircraft, and they started to notice some valve recession on the Lycoming engines in the school airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's a problem because you don't want to have, you know, any kind of valve recession. It could easily lead to more significant problems with an engine. And so UND said, we're going to stop using that fuel as of when they said it. And I want to say, Ian, we've talked about this a couple of times. So it's probably been about 2 months or so since that happened. I want to say October, maybe even, or November.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That's right.
But there's more to the story, as you would think.
Yeah, there is.
Right.
Yeah, there is. This was, I think, surprising to everybody because these Lycoming engines were supposed to have hardened valves to guard against this, basically.
That was something that came about because of a change in fuel back in the 70s. Right? The valve technology was changed.
Yeah, exactly. What we learned
in
automobiles from going from leaded to unleaded in automobiles. That's right. So if you have a relatively modern engine, you should have hardened valves.
Mm-hmm.
And these airplanes certainly did. And so, you know, the idea was, well, it really shouldn't have happened. Now, so Lycoming has looked at the engines, talked to UND, and they say basically it's Swift's fault.
They're saying the aromatics in the fuel have something to do with this.
Yep.
The aromatics are a couple of different chemicals.
Yeah, that's right. So apparently that's like benzene, toluene.
Toluene.
Yeah, that's right.
Xylene.
Yeah, I'm going to say all these wrong. Yeah, they boost the octane of the fuel and do other things for it, you know, these additives.
But the key thing there might be a quote unquote particulate abrasiveness to valve seats that may contribute to valve seat recession, which is what Lycoming said about Swift fuel.
May do this, may do that. It's interesting. I would say their statement was not really conclusive. They say, you know, that the components of the engine and the specs are not believed to have contributed to the valve seat recession. Of course, they think that. Lycoming says it's not their problem. What does Swift think about that?
Well, I'll tell you what Chris DaCosta of Swift Fuel thinks about it. By the way, the door is still open for Chris to come on the Hangar Talk show. We do want him to come and speak with us. He says that Lycoming's assessment is inconclusive, and he disputes the claim about the aromatics. And DaCosta did, however, recommend pilots flying these engines with his fuel limit their lean of peak operations, and he recommended procedures that will additionally reduce the risk of the valve issues. Like, don't operate at peak EGT, or like I said, at lean of peak EGT, and flying the UL-94 unleaded gas until a comprehensive analysis of the exhaust valve issue is documented and confirmed by industry. So Chris thinks differently of that. So he's pointing the finger back at UND to a degree. Like, hey, what are your operating parameters? What are you teaching the students?
Mm-hmm.
How are you teaching the students to fly?
Yeah.
How are you teaching them to maintain their engines, which is a valid point.
Yeah.
And there's so many of us, Ian, that have grown up on very simple engines with fixed pitch props, without EGT, you know, digital EGT gauges. The question is, do pilots really know how to operate engines using a pretty fancy EGT gauge?
Yeah.
And are they leaning their engines properly? And I wonder what the Ask the A&Ps group thinks of this.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, I hear Mike in my head, right? It's like, this just stinks to me because for so many reasons. And let me start with the fact that this is a flight school. I haven't seen UND's, operating specs and how they teach people to fly. But we all know from flight training that most of it happens below about 3,000 feet, mostly at full rich, unless you're doing cross countries.
Right.
People are not leaning on their way to the practice area generally.
But they're leaning on the ground a little bit sometimes.
Well, they might be. They should. But your power is so low, you're not going to hurt anything when you do that.
Well, that's the other thing. My mechanic, Tom Young, says your power is so low on the ground when you're idling and you're taxiing that leaning it during that time period is like, why are you doing that? Like, and I was taught to always lean when you're on the ground. But Tom's like, the carbon deposits aren't going to foul the plugs at that low of a setting.
Hmm.
But when you advance the throttle for the run up, that's when you need to take a couple of seconds and advance slowly. Maybe that's when some of this is happening.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, so it's like the idea that a flight school is operating at peak EGT or lean of peak, I just find to be
below 3,000 feet, you would never lean an engine like that. No.
Yeah, no, they're not going to. And in flight training where you're doing constant maneuvers, you're just not going to.
Never. No, because you'll forget to unlean it and they'll cause more harm.
Yes.
And so the typical instructors they want you to concentrate on the maneuvers and being able to fly the airplane rather than getting mixed up with a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Now, the other thing he says is, we know from engine instrumentation that operating at peak EGT or lean of peak EGT is actually, you find cooler cylinder temperatures and cylinder pressures, and you actually are being nicer to the engine. The worst thing that you can do is operate about 50 degrees rich of peak EGT, right?
Right. That's the box you don't want to be in. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, his suggestion that operating at peak EGT or lean of peak is a problem just stinks. It just doesn't make sense to me.
It's the adverse of what you would normally think, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
You think you're treating the engine better.
Yeah.
If you're flying it with cooler cylinder head temperatures, that's got to be better for the engine, I would think.
Yeah, and I would think that these airplanes have, I would hope that UND captured the data from these things for the past, 4 or 5 months that they ran this. And so we know what the temperatures were.
Well, Ian, they're flying basically brand new Pipers. Flying. They accepted delivery of a bunch of low-wing Pipers. Those aircraft are instrumented well. The engines were new. I mean, the airplanes are new, relatively speaking, within a couple of years. Now, of course, they put a lot of flight time on those engines because it's, happened in school.
Yeah.
But it's not like they're out there with a 2,000-hour, 20-year-old engine in the first place.
Yeah, there are so many unanswered questions here. I mean, the other is, they talk about valve seat recession being an issue here. And I wonder, it's like, okay, for you to say conclusively that this would have to be a problem, you would have had to have had a baseline bit of data that you've been looking at all along. So was it that just that the mechanics, that the shop at UND was so tuned in to what was going on that they started looking at this carefully and said, oh, wait, there's valve seat recession in these airplanes, when really it's the same thing that's been going on forever under 100 low lead, and they just didn't know because they weren't paying attention?
In other words, they had a reason to look further,
exactly.
And so they did look further.
So they found stuff just because they were looking. And the other question is, like Mike says, were they measuring it properly?
Yeah.
He said it's really hard to measure valve seat recession with the engine hung on the airplane. So I don't know. I just think there's still so many questions here, and it just doesn't surprise me that everyone's sort of pointing the finger to each other. Really, the losers in all this are, I think, everybody who's anxious to transition to an unleaded fuel, because this is obviously a step back in the process.
Right.
And is going to cause all of us to kind of like put on the brakes and be like, okay, really, what is going on?
Right.
And when everybody's pointing the finger to each other, it's not very helpful, right? It's just going to slow down the process even more.
And just realize this, don't forget, unfortunately, in California, Ian, some of the municipalities, some of the airports there have had to stop selling regular avgas, what we know as 100 unleaded, because of various local rulings. So that forced some of the airports into having only Swift UL-94. And then now what do the pilots do? Do they fly to another airport to fill up before they go somewhere on a trip or what?
I don't know. Interesting.
Well, I think there'll be more finger pointing ahead.
Yes. We look forward to the finger pointing.
I like your point, counterpoint on this. I still would love to have Chris DaCosta on this show.
I'd love Chris to come on.
We know that he's developing a 100 unleaded as well, and there's high hope for that too.
Yes.
So I think there's a lot more to report on this, and we're just, you know, there's too many questions right now and not enough answers, really.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Hey, David, let's move on to Maurice and his trio of toys, specifically the Marchetti jet, which is just a cool, cool little airplane.
Hi, my name is Mauricio Frizarin, and we are at the Wellington Aero Club in Florida.
And you live here and keep all your toys here. Tell us about the aircraft that are in this hangar.
Yes, I live here, and it's really nice to have the toys, you know, all around, because you can, you know, get and fly and go everywhere. It's really cool, especially to us that loves planes and helicopters, you know, all these toys. This is a Marchetti jet. It is an Italian trainer fighter jet. And it was operating in many countries like Singapore and other small countries. When the Italian created this plane, was to compete to United States, like an, I don't know if an auction or something like that. They had a project, I think it was AT-45. I don't remember the name of the project, but they tried to sell this plane to United States. And then it was a huge contract. They fight for the contract, but they lose for another plane. And then the Italians lost this competition, the contract, and then start selling planes all around the world. And they sold only 65 of these planes. And Singapore Air Force was the largest operator of this plane. And then after a while, they started selling. And then now I believe it's 12 flying here in the United States and some all around the world. Italy, Europe, and other places.
Why did you want to buy a Marchetti?
I mean, it was two options. One option to land here. We have a 4,000 feet runway, and we have a noise restrictions, a lot of restrictions in because it's a community. And then the two options was this one, which has like Citation II engines, which is super common, and all the parts are easy to find and easy to fly, and it's pressurized, has air conditioner, and also is all the controls are hydraulic. It's super like comfortable to fly. And my target was to fly formation. And this plane to fly formation is one of the best because all the controls are hydraulic and easy maintenance. And then I bought one. And then later on, when I discovered that few of them, brand new, was for sale in an auction. And my luck is my friend bought four of them in Europe and brought to United States. He put new avionics, took off all the military stuff and put new engines and then put for sale. And then this one behind me has like 300 hours since new. It's of course but it's still an old plane, 1989. But it was sitting in a hangar in a judicial dispute. Can I say that? Yeah. Then I was in this judicial dispute with the Italians and the buyers, the country. I don't know which country, but I think it's a Middle East country that bought. They got a disagreement between the Italian manufacturer and the country. And then the jets stayed in the hangar for, I don't know, 30 years. Mm. And then they decided, an international court decided to send them to an auction. And my friend bought four. He sold here in the United States, and I bought one.
So let's kind of go backwards and talk about where you were born and how you got involved in aviation and then how you came to the United States.
Okay, I was born in São Paulo, Brazil. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a pilot. And then I discovered that I had myopia in one eye. And then when I talked to a doctor, they say, no, if you have myopia, you cannot be a pilot, an ATP. You need have like 20/20 in both eyes without lenses. It was the guy told me when I was 17 years old. And then I gave up. I said, okay, let's do another thing. And then another passion was software. I started developing softwares. After a few years, I was always going to the airport. And then I succeeded very well in the software side. I was selling a lot and making a lot of money. And then after a few years, I went back and met a guy in the airport, like close by my city in Brazil. And the guy said, no, you can be a pilot. I said, no. Yeah, if I'm now, it's better because I can buy a plane. I mean, of course, tiny plane, but I could buy the plane. And then I went to the doctor. I did my medical and I passed it. Was so like I made a party, you know. When I got my medical, I said, oh, I can't fly. And then I got my medical, went back, started having classes. Since then, I never stopped flying. And then I was growing and doing everything like I could do to improve my skills. Like I came to United States a lot of time, many times to improve my skills, because here is of course, you have everything, simulators, you have all the stuff here in the United States, which we didn't have in Brazil. Now we have a little more there, but was nothing like here. You know, all the simulators, trainings, and specialized places. And then I was improving myself, my skills, and started growing my aviation. I started with a Cessna 172, and then I went to a twin engine, a turboprop, and then a jet, and then I never stopped it. And then when I came here to United States, after I sold my company in 2014, and then I moved to United States, I moved with my plane, and I put the helicopter for sale, and I couldn't sell the helicopter. And then after 2 years waiting to sell, I said, you know what? I'm going to bring the helicopter. It was nice. It was really, really good. 1 week flying from Brazil to here in a helicopter was awesome. Super nice.
Why? As a boy in Brazil, did you want to be a pilot? What did you see or what turned you on to wanting to be a pilot?
Oh, it's hard to explain, but like I have a passion for the planes. I used to go to the airport and keep, you know, just staring, like looking for the planes, landing, taking off. And then when I had a chance with a friend, like fly with me, I take all the chances, like try to fly the plane. It was really cool. I don't know, I cannot explain why. This passion, but I think it's the freedom, or like you can fly, you can see everywhere from this the top. It's hard to explain.
So you fly everything from the 172 all the way up to this very fast jet, right?
Yeah.
What is your passion? Is it all, does it take all of aviation, or do you like it faster?
No, I think all of the aviation. Like I like helicopters because the versatility, you can land everywhere. Like you can stop in the air. It's different. And it's kind of slow compared to jets. It's really slow, but it's a different kind of aviation. And also I have a seaplane, an Icon. That is another thing because you can land in the water. And it's like a jet ski with wings. And then, I mean, I love everything that flies. Even I had a Boeing Stearman in the middle of this, you know, between all of this. I had a Boeing Stearman, T6, and many planes that even is low, but so cool to fly. Like a Boeing Stearman is really, really nice airplane and really slow.
Let's concentrate on the Marchetti a little bit. Tell me about the aircraft and tell me what it's like to fly it.
Initially, let's start in the beginning. When I came, I saw the guy landing the jet, said, oh my God, the guy landing the jet in my community, like where I live, said, I need to know this guy. And I went there and I asked him how to buy and have the license. And then he said, oh, it's not a big deal to buy, but to have a license, you must have 1,000 hours in jets. I said, I have a little bit more, like 1,200, but it's a lot. He said, no, it's not a big deal to fly this kind of jet. And then I got the training, and the jet is awesome because you can fly slowly, like a normal corporate jet, or you can fly hard, like aerobatics, you can do whatever you want. And also it's still, like, because the hydraulics and AC and everything, and visibility, because you have all the bubble on top of the aircraft, and then you can see everything, and you feel like really comfortable, even flying super close, like information. You feel like really well, like the plane is super responsive and trustable.
Do you fly in formation with team or anything or with friends?
Yeah, I fly a lot of information. Since I think I started 10 years ago, or like training, took me a long time to get there, like for training, because it's not easy to get a lot of guys together to do training, like four planes at least to train fly formation. And then it's not something that I want to go tomorrow. It's not saying like that. I mean, maybe next month and months later to get together all the people to fly formation. Then it takes a long time.
Are you on a team?
Yeah. And then I created a team later. I started just with friends. Like we go for clinics and like FAST and other clinics. And then get together and spend like the weekend or 3 days flying like 2-3 times a day. Like just training, really hard training, military training. Most of the people that teach us like how to fly are former militaries. And then was really cool, like to learn a lot more. And I enjoyed a lot even to learn. Was kind of scary, you know. First day I said, no, I cannot do that. Like the first training, it was super close. And then the guy turns it against you. So, oh my God. No, because you are like 300 knots. And then the other plane is really close to you. And you need to get closer, closer, closer. And it was scary. When I end my first flight, I said, it's not for me. And then the second flight was, maybe. And then the third flight, said, oh no, if I train a lot, I can do it. And then I still training. And after, I don't know, almost a year, I got my card, my wing card, and I never stopped flying. And then I have like a lot of friends has planes, and we get together and start flying, like just for fun. And then later I found a guy, friend, who had an L-39. And he used to work to a company, like for publicity. And then I said, oh, why we don't create a team? Because in that time I had two Marquettis. And so we could, you know, get three planes and create a team. Then we can fly formation by just one more guy. That's it. And then we got some pilots and we had three planes. And then we created Kion, and that's why born at Kion Aerosports. And then the idea is to do like air shows, having fun, and make some marketing for the company. Because, you know, like I was doing this for free, and it's for myself. And I said, oh, now I'm working.
And why are you named Gitmo?
I think it was because these friends, they used to have to give a nickname, right? And then usually in the military, but I was never military. And they give this name because I always want to learn more, like get more skills and learn more and get another plane and get another. And that's why, you know, Gitmo.
Very good. So tell me about the aircraft itself, its engines and its what it's made up of.
It's an Italian aircraft made from Marchetti, now becomes Agusta, and now is the same company was Marchetti, was CI, and then Marchetti, then CI Marchetti, and then becomes Agusta, and then becomes Leonardo. It's the same brand of the helicopters. And then, as I said, this is a trainer jet. You can put bomb, one rocket, and one machine gun. I have the rockets, of course, fake, but I have. And a friend asked, oh, can you drop? I said, yes, but it costs like $4,000 each drop. It's going to cost me too much. No, I don't want to. Just for fun. But it has a Pratt & Whitney engine. It's one of the things that I really like this jet, because it's the engine that is a commercial jet has. It's a JD15-4C. The speed is 400 knots maximum. It's not like super powered. It's underpowered, actually, because it's a trainer jet. And then the idea is to have something reliable that don't burns too much fuel. This is another good thing, because I don't burn like tons of fuel every flight, which is really good, because when you have a plane that burns too much fuel, you are sometimes, oh, I'm going to fly now and cost me thousands of dollars. But it's not the case.
What does it burn?
Burns like normal, like a normal flight. Usually, if I'm doing just aerobatics or just a little flight, like 30 minutes, burns 50 gallons. It's pretty much like 100 gallons an hour, which is not so bad. And you have a really good price on fuel here in the community. And the plane has air conditioner, pressurization, all the controls are hydraulic to make it super easy, even in fast speed. It's easy to control. It can have minus 2 Gs plus 6 Gs for aerobatics. It can fly inverted for like 1 minute, or just not too much, but you know, 1 minute inverted is fine. Has two seats, you can operate from, the pilot needs to be in the front seat, but you can fly from the back seat as well. It has a really good view because you are a lot taller, and it's really good. It's kind of easy to fly. Like if you have a jet experience, I think it's an easy jet to fly.
How did you find the Aero Club of Wellington, and why did you decide to move here?
First, I started seeing places to bring my planes. When I came here, I had a Citation Sovereign. Then I came flying, like for the first time, and stayed here. I keep my plane in the airport. And then what I still have on that time, I still have the T-6, the Boeing Stearman, helicopter, and other planes and toys, let's say. And then it was in Brazil. And then I was looking for a place like this, a flying community. And then I started visiting many places around Miami, because I was living in Miami. I want to find somewhere close to Miami, or a hangar, maybe. But a community was better, because you have friends, you have everyone that loves aviation, are in the same place. And sometimes people in the airports, they just go to get the plane as a transportation, and that's it. It's not the same, let's say, same mood. And then I was trying to find these places and started visiting all the places. The crazy thing is, when I bought my first jet, it was a CJ2, and I bought for a Brazilian friend. But the jet was here in the United States. And then I met a guy who gave me training to fly the Citation. And then I got my license, I keep going. And for a while, I asked him to fly with me, especially coming back and forth to the United States, because it's international, we are crossing the Americas. It was good to have a pilot that does it many times for safety. And then I met this guy. I didn't know he lives here. Then I was looking in these places, like I went to many of them around Miami. And one is a grass runway. Well, grass runway is not so good, because if I want to have a jet, I can't. Works for my planes, but doesn't work for the jets. Then I went to the second one, and then the third one. And then, oh, this is too far. I cannot drive. And this is, oh, this is, the runway is too short. And then in everywhere, people asking me, oh, do you know Wellington? I said, no, I never been there. Oh, you need, should go. And then I went to the second one, same answer. Oh, do you know Wellington? I said, no. And then, it's craziness, the guy who I bought the Citation, like years before that, sent me a video with this pilot that was here, doing like an interview about the Wellington Air Club. The same pilot that trained me in the Citation and flew with me many times. And he was like doing kind of advertisement about the community. And then at the end, he sent me, not because of the community, because I said, oh, take a look at our old friend. And then I saw and said, oh, I'm going to call him. I got his phone, called, and said, yeah, come here, I show you. And then I came here, and he showed me all the how it works, showed me some people, went to many hangars, and now this is the place. This is the place. And then, so just to make sure, when I rent a house first, before I buy, just make sure that the community is cool. And then I rented the house for a year. I moved here, like just weekends, still with the apartment in Miami. Then when I was like mostly living half and half, let's say, this house went for sale. And then I saw the house, oh, this is a huge potential. And it has a big space for a new hangar that doesn't have this hangar on time I bought the house. And then I spent these days, come here. And then a little bit before the pandemic, I was living, let's say, a little more here than in Miami. But after that, in the pandemic, I said, no, definitely. I sold my apartment. I'm going to live here. And then I made an office. I had an office at Brickell. Then I made an office inside the hangar. And then I said, no, now, you know, like everyone has sometimes like a beautiful view, beach view. I had airplane view from my, you know, working and seeing the planes. It was really cool. And then I figured out that it was not so good, because the smell of jet fuel, like all day long, every day, was kind of too much. And then I moved myself to an office besides here. But and then I never bought another apartment. I was living here because it's really nice. You know, the community is nice. It's quiet. I mean, except of course when planes are flying. But it's nice as well.
Do you take advantage of like being friends and doing the community stuff? Is there a lot of community stuff here?
Yeah, I mean, it's a super nice community. Most of the houses has hangars. I mean, I think it's most of them. So just some houses are out of the taxiways. I believe we have here around 400 houses and more planes than that, because a lot of people has many planes and helicopters, and you know, it's really nice. We have a fuel farm that we can buy fuel for cost price, which is really good. We have a runway with a 4,000 feet, which is pretty good. We have a lot of jets here. There is just a limitation in the community, which is 12,500 pounds, the maximum airplane, which is a CJ2, the maximum size of airplane that you can have here. I think another crazy number is here we have, I think, 7 M2s, which is kind of a new plane. And in one airport, 7 is a lot. There's so many like airplanes the same kind in a community. It's because the size of the runway, you cannot have so many different planes. And the community is so nice because, you know, everyone loves airplanes. And then you have mechanic, you have professional pilot, you have a guy who has training facility with simulator and all kinds of. It gets busy in the morning because a lot of people that lives here works in somewhere, or an airport, or close to an airport, and then they get a plane and go to work like a car. And then so many of them, many. It's not one or two. It's like 10, 20 people that works with planes and go to work, a helicopter or a plane, and go to work and come back late afternoon. And then in the morning, it's kind of busy. And then late afternoon is busy again. But in the middle, it's like time by time, of course, someone lands, someone take off, or training, or flying around.
Is there a clubhouse and a organized stuff that you guys do together, as opposed to the ad hoc, you know, call up on a morning or something?
Yeah, we have a clubhouse here near the fuel farm. Usually, we have no scheduled events. Like a few days ago, another community came here for a lunch, and they come with planes and meet with all the residents. Then they make a get together with all the planes coming here, knowing the facility. And also we have every Sunday afternoon before the sunset, everyone drives the car to there and stays together drinking and seeing the sunset. Nobody says exactly the time because it's like 30 minutes before sunset, and stays until the sunset, gets dark, go home. But us, it's really cool. You know, everyone telling like aviation stories, and we have a lot of former jet pilots that was in the war, and it's really cool.
Is there a HOA, a homeowner's fee that has to be paid?
Yes, we have a homeowner's fee, but it's not too much. It's really reasonable. They take care with the grass around, basically, take care with the runway and clubhouse and the fuel farm. And then it's not expensive. It's really reasonable. It's a private runway. You need prior authorization to come, even for guests. What we do is, if I have a guest coming, I send the paperwork. Mostly is the paperwork from the plane and insurance. And then I send to the community just to register that I'm receiving a guest. And then if someone sees a plane, so knows that this is my guest, and then it can stay in my house. In my case, I can have a lot of plenty of space here for a guest plane. Or we have a space in the back of the clubhouse, that a big space for a lot of planes. And then a guest can come with a plane, if I don't have space, park there, refuel the plane, whatever, and then come to the house and stay here and get the plane and go out. But yes, you cannot like just come and land here because it's private runway.
And do you have an association board that oversees everything?
Yes, we do. We have a board. I think it stands for 2 years. Every 2 years we change. We just change it, the board of directors.
And they basically set the rules and...
Yeah, okay. They set the rules and take care if someone is doing something wrong and fix things. You know, then try to get some improvement. You can schedule, have the clubhouse to use. I'm not using too much. I mean, I never use it, to be honest, because my house is super big and I have plenty of space here. But you can have the clubhouse, use the clubhouse like I want to invite some people and use, or just people from here. And they mean special events, like schedule some, you know, like parties. You know, they create some party.
Do you have like a newsletter? Do they send online?
No, yeah, they send only online. We have a website.
Okay.
And they send emails, but they don't have anything like a journal, okay, something like that. A lot of things are really great. If you need something, someone can help you. 100% sure. Like some neighbor can come and help and know someone that can fix our plane or do whatever you need. And also, like I don't have pilot. And then I need to bring the plane for maintenance. Sometimes I need a ride back. And then one neighbor can go. It's 100% sure someone can go with you. And then of course, reciprocity, when they need, they call and I go as well. But and we do a lot of things like that. And sometimes like we have a group of all the community group. And they said, oh, let's take a coffee, a breakfast in the Sunday morning. And then get one plane and go. Doesn't matter if you have seat, you know, you wanna go for your plane, you wanna fly. And then fly in the morning, go to somewhere, have breakfast and come back. It's super cool. Sometimes go to the and land in a lake and try to get breakfast, you know, from a lake, try to do something cool. Or, I mean, I went for shooting in a shooting range with the helicopter. We landed in the place, go shooting, come back, get the helicopter and go home. It's awesome.
It's a hard not life, huh?
Yeah.
I think everyone wants to be like Mauricio. Yeah. He has got the coolest group of aircraft mm-hmm. that's available to him. And he's an airshow pilot, too, and a nice guy and a really smart person. It was great to meet him. And he's just, and I got to fly with him, got to fly in his helicopter. He was great.
Yeah, very cool. All right, David, I think that's all the time we have. I'm Ian Twombly. Our editor is Austin Hansen.
And I'm David Tulis. Don't forget, you can find us at AOPA.org/hangartalk and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. We'll see you next time.
See you next time, Ian.
Hangar Talk from AOPA, your freedom to fly.